A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to On the Continent, your one-stop shop for all things to do with European football. I'm Dotton Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm David Carlidge.
In this edition's World Cup qualifier conversation, it's that man Griezmann again for France. Will he do the same for club as for country now that he's back in Madrid? Same question of Memphis Depay. After banging him in for the Netherlands in the internationals, Barcelona will be looking to him to do the same for them post-Messi. And looking ahead to one of the most tantalising fixtures of the weekend, it's the return of the Don of Bayern Munich to his old haunts in Leipzig, and there ain't enough room in town for the both of them, if you know what I mean. So before we start talking about the French national team and the fortunes of Antoine Griezmann, should we talk about the big punch-up Nice against Marseille, as it were?
Yes, crime and punishment on the Côte d'Azur for that game a couple of weeks ago. Extraordinary scenes where you
Is that actually a book by Leo Tolstoy? Sorry, Fyodor Dostoevsky or not?
But maybe that's going to be the follow-up. But it was an extraordinary scene in a match that a lot of people were looking forward to. And it all broke down about the 74th minute when some Marseille players and some Nice fans got into it physically on the pitch after Dimitri Payet, of course, was hit by a bottle and threw him back. Marseille players have been the subject of items thrown from the crowd, not just in that, but in the game against Montpellier a couple of weeks before that. So anyway, the game was abandoned. The Nice have been fined one point for now. They've got another point suspended, and they're going to have to replay the entire game, which they were leading 1-0 in. So their players must be fuming, actually, at what went on in the stands. And, yeah, they've got to replay it without fans on neutral ground, which is... I mean, Nice couldn't be allowed to get away with this. I mean, it was dangerous what happened. And, yeah, I know the French authorities were very keen not to start closing bits of stadiums or closing stadiums entirely again, especially when we've just come out of the pandemic and fans have just got back in after barely being near any French stadiums last season. But they were just left with no choice.
So let's talk about France, the national team then. David, they looked a far better team than Finland.
Yeah, absolutely. I think given the manner of how they exited the Euros, I think it was mightily important that they put on a bit of a statement performance. Also, of course, there was no Kylian Mbappe there. So I think it was really, really important that they showed that, you know, the amount of talent that they have, the quality that they have, that they showed that they can still, you know, they're still capable of putting on a performance.
And they needed a big performance, really, didn't they, David? Yeah. Because, of course, previously in this international break, they drew Bosnia in Strasbourg. They went to Ukraine and drew there. And after that, they've got five draws in a row, if you include the Switzerland game, obviously, yeah, that they ended up losing on penalties. And just the manner as well, it's just a sense of this team is stuck, that it has no real shape, no real direction. And for the first time in a while, Didier Deschamps did something tactically that I felt worked. Going back to three at the back, which was like really just a disaster against Switzerland. It didn't work at all, and they wasted the first 45 minutes of that game. But this time, I think Lars might have pinpointed it before, mm-hmm, they've brought in someone who was really suited to playing wing back in Theo Hernandez. Mm.
Yeah, I think he's fantastic, Aaron. And when he switched on, he's an absolutely remarkable player. I think a lot of the time with Theo, he doesn't seem completely focused on football, and he doesn't. If he just channels drive, determination into his game, because quality-wise, ability-wise, he has it all. He's incredible physically as well. He's a big lad, and for him to get up and down the flank as he does, I think with his size and his power, there's not many players around. He reminds me a lot of when Gareth Bale was deployed at fullback at Spurs. He actually reminds me a lot of Bale. I think he's the closest to him in that incarnation of Bale as a fullback.
That's right, because he's so much ability. But you get the impression his mind wanders a little bit sometimes.
He's one of those players, I think, who doesn't fully care about football, and which is completely fine. It doesn't have to be his be-all and end-all, his entire life. You know, I don't think he's somebody who finishes a game and then goes home and watches another six games over the weekend. You know, he's one of those people. And I think that's, you know, but if he did have that little bit of extra, then he could go extremely, extremely far.
I mean, something's changed with him, I think, since he's been at Milan, though.
Yeah.
Because he's been a key player there. He's been given responsibility. And for the first time, he's not Luca's little brother. Yeah. I think that makes a massive difference. And now with him out, the fact that he's got into the full French national team, especially a night like this, when they need not just a result, Don, but performance. And they do it in front of a sold-out crowd in Lyon. Karim Benzema, of course, is going back to play at the Groupama Stadium for the first time, which is a big deal. They make a huge fuss over him. You know, there's real atmosphere. And, you know, journalists in France were saying there was something different about the feel of this, not just because the stadium's filled up again, but because the way that people belted out the anthem before the start is like, come on. Let's not just cruise through this. We've been cruising through things for far too long, France. We've got to go and get this. And they did.
Also, though, it did seem as if the crowd got what they wanted in terms of just a spectacle. You know, particularly there was a period where they were in and around the Finnish penalty area and Finland just couldn't get out of it. And France was playing such skillful football, it must have been a pleasure to watch. So would that have got them over the Euro failure blues, as it were. And
it's a start.
Looking forward to the World Cup now.
It's a start, definitely. And I think now, you know, they're in such a comfy position in the group now. I think you're right. I think the style is as important as the results, because they look so disjointed throughout the Euros. Yeah. And I think the interesting thing, David, is like how, I mean, obviously, Antoine Griezmann was the star in this game. He was absolutely fantastic. Two goals for him. The connection with Benzema was fantastic.
It really was.
It looked kind of easier for them with Mbappe out of the way.
I know it's the exchange 20 passes between each other. It was the most between any two players on the field that night. They look to have a good little synergy going on. But the big thing is trying to fit Mbappe in there somehow. And that's going to be the big task, I think. You know, if we're looking at France ahead of the World Cup and things that they need to sort, I think getting Mbappe, get a true role for Mbappe. I think we discussed this during the Euros as well. It just felt like he was thrown in there. Oh, he's got all the talent, but there was no actual role carved out for him.
But this is interesting because it's another way of looking at the conversation, as you say, that people have been having about France for months.
Yeah.
Because you realise now that there's just not been enough of Griezmann in the penalty box.
No.
You know, and that is where he's absolutely vital.
He's extremely intelligent. He's a really, really intelligent player outside the box and inside the box as well.
But that's the thing, because he will just get on with stuff, because he's someone who's a real worker and always has been, ever since he was at Real Sociedad as a kid, that's why he connected with Simeone in such a big way. That basically, if he gets shoved out of the spotlight, he'll just get on with it. He'll still do a decent job for the team. Yeah. But is that where he's serving the team best? And the answer's probably no. I mean, you look with these goals, 41 international goals now, which matches Michel Platini's thing. We've been talking so much recently about Olivier Giroud's going to get the all-time record, isn't he? I don't think he is. He's still five adrift of Henry. He wasn't picked for this squad for sporting reasons, as Didier Deschamps put it, rather than anything else. It's Griezmann that's going to take him over, isn't it?
It's quite incredible, though, for him to have the goal-scoring record that he does, considering where he plays and the rest of the work that he does for the team as well.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the time he is quite far removed from goal. And Platini was obviously closer to goal the more often. So it's interesting to see Griezmann do that.
What puzzles me about Griezmann is that he has seemed to have performed better for France than he was for Barcelona. I know he had all sorts of issues at Barcelona, and I wonder whether now when he goes back to Atletico, they will give him whatever France has given him, David, in terms of freedom to move around the place and do what he does best.
I think he will. I think he's going to get that role back that he had at Atleti that they never really replaced. They tried João Félix there for a little bit. He couldn't really do it, which I completely understood. Completely different type of player. And now he can go back and slot into it. I think that role is still there for him. And I think it's a great move in his career. It was probably quite unexpected in a way. He probably felt that he was going to be when he signed that Barcelona deal, he probably felt he was going to be there quite a while. But I think this is really, really good timing for both player and club in regard to Atleti. The hair's already come off as well, that horrible ponytail.
I mean, can I just say, we talked about like the... How unusual the whole situation is. I don't think I've seen, because he scored these two goals on the Tuesday. On Wednesday morning, he's back in Spain, he's back in Madrid, meeting the old teammates, get a big hug from Stefan Savic, and wouldn't we all like a big hug from Stefan Savic, in the car park. He trains with the ponytail on, and he gets the haircut in between the training session and the presentation.
Did you see the state of Atleti's mentions, though? So every single reply to Atleti's tweet, I think Griezmann tweeted, he was just saying, oh, hey guys, I'm here, I'm back. And every single reply was a picture of a wild hair clipper. I mean, every single one. I genuinely think he's doing that. But also, there might be actually a psychological thing behind this, in that, you know, I think a lot of people who have been in bad relationships, what do they do when they get out of it? They maybe do something crazy with their hair or their style. I think maybe he's done that. He's got out of a bad relationship.
They do lose their grooming sponsorship. Yeah. So be careful about that, Antoine.
Flips it back for the Frenchman. That one is going to count. A work of art for Griezmann. The Louvre is calling by
Barcelona. They want to hang that one. That one up in their fancy museum in Paris.
Another player who is firing, certainly in the international perspective, is Memphis Depay. And he's Barcelona's front man, and yet he perhaps hasn't been given the credit that he should be given. If you put him in the sort of perspective, if you put him in the perspective of the replacement to Messi, people almost laugh him out of the field. Whereas when you see him play for the Netherlands, you might get it. You know, against Turkey and against Montenegro, when you see him play those matches, you might start to get it why he is Barcelona's front man. He's firing, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Because he feels like it's worked out really well for him, this, because at the Netherlands, he's been the main man for quite some time. They don't have a raft of superstars, and he has been probably the most gifted player that they have in an attacking sense. And right now at Barcelona, he is the main man there as well. And he probably likes that responsibility. He likes having that, I think, on his shoulders. He's a little bit older now as well, and he's matured slightly. And I compare him to Benzema in a little bit like this, because people don't really take them seriously, players like Memphis and Benzema, because they look at how they behave off the pitch, and it's not bad, by the way. They're interested in their music, their fashion, and what have you like that. So people think, oh, they, you know, and like football doesn't matter to them. But you
fans want everyone to be Harry Kane. Basically.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's boring. It's the last thing I want players to be is Harry Kane. You know, and you look at Memphis and you look at Benzema and how they've matured as they've got older. They're a lot older right now. They're not kids now. You know, to hold Memphis accountable and still judging by that spell at Manchester United that he had when he left.
He's not the same player.
No, he left. No,
but a lot of people look at him as if he's still that player,
yeah,
don't they?
That's wild. It's such a silly thing to do. And I think the way he's matured and he's had, and you'll know better than me how he's had Leon on his back, for quite some time now. And this just feels like a nice step for him. I don't think it's a last chance saloon or anything like that. I think it's just, it's come about at the right time. I think he's ready for this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we touched on it in the ramble earlier this week. The fact that his level of confidence is such, whereas like a lot of people would say replacing Messi is the impossible task, and of course it is the impossible task. Mm-hmm. But he's someone who'll be, yeah, I can do that. You know, he believes in himself so strongly, and that's exactly what you need.
Did he have that belief when he was at Manchester United?
I think he had that belief. I don't think he had the maturity or the tools to get through it, or really the opportunity, because, of course, he was coming into a post-Ferguson situation. I think if he turns up at United and he's coached by Sir Alex Ferguson, it's a different story for him at United.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, funnily enough, the coach who's absolutely key in this, who's nowhere near the same level of star, is Bruno Genesio, now the coach of Rennes, who was at Lyon at the time. Because when he arrives at Lyon, he's a club record signing. It's a big deal because they're getting a player from Manchester United. And then for the big games, there's a bit of friction eventually between Genesio and Jean-Michel Aulas, the president, and the people on the board, because they've made a big song and dance about bringing in a media star. And he is a star. Whether he's that level as a footballer yet is another question in 2017. But Genesio leaves him out of the big games, because when they're playing PSG, when they're playing Marseille, he's like, I cannot have him on the left wing because he doesn't do any defending. And it works in two ways. Firstly, because Genesio brings him on later in those games. And if you look up Memphis great goals for Leon, as I do on a daily basis, obviously, one of those is when he comes on as sub against PSG and scores a brilliant goal to win the game in like the 92nd minute. And you can see that anger on him because he's like, I've got bench for this and it sucks. And he's really full of piss and vinegar. But eventually, Aulas, the president, and the board are like, we bet the farm on this guy and you're leaving him out for the big games. Come on. And he's like, well, this is why I'm leaving him out. Eventually, they come to the solution of playing him at centre forward. And that is where he's best.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be on the wing in the first place. Now, of course, he can drift into wide areas.
He still drifts.
Oh, yeah. And he's got the trickery to do it really well. But you can't give him defensive responsibility. If you make him your centre forward, I think, fortunately, we're coming out of this space in football now where we think to be a centre forward, you have to be like, you know, built like a nightclub bouncer, or play off someone who's built like a nightclub bouncer. And, you know, maybe it'd be interesting to see how he clicks with Luke de Jong at Barcelona. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see how that works. But Memphis is best at centre forward. And he does have that maturity, not just to take that responsibility, but make the most of that responsibility. I think the best thing about these two games, and you're right to point out those two games, Dotton in Amsterdam, against Montenegro and Turkey, all together, 5 goals and an assist in those two games. I mean, that is absolutely fantastic stuff by any
just
standards.
Just from Memphis Depay.
Just from Memphis. That is brilliant. And you look at that, and you look at the way that after the Montenegro game, which was already very good before the real high point of Turkey where he gets his hat-trick, and Louis van Gaal comes out and says, that was the perfect performance, 10 out of 10. He could not have played any better. Like, if you're pleasing van Gaal to that extent... Yeah. I mean, that's impressive.
Yeah, Louis van Gaal is looking like the beneficiary of this as well. You know, given, you know, both of the player and the manager's Manchester United connections, is he any different from the coach that left Old Trafford?
I don't think so. He's one of those guys who will never, ever change.
I don't want him to change.
I was going to say he is very much who he is, the character and his outlook, and his training sessions will still be the same. You know, the way he speaks to players and operates with them one-to-one will stay the same as well. Nice. He's too long in the tooth, I think.
And I have to say the best Van Gaal Memphis moment was that thing with the journalist.
Yeah,
what wasn't it? Where he's talking about, you know, you're into Chelsea and they're more defensive football, isn't he? And it's brilliant. The bit between the journalist asking the question and then Van Gaal answering it and going, you know zero about football, et cetera, et cetera. The camera cuts away and looks at Memphis, takes a little swig from his drink, and he's like, oh dear, you don't know what you've done here. you've unleashed the beast with just this very knowing smile.
Contenders, though, the Netherlands, in terms of the World Cup, are they contenders?
I feel it's a bit soon to say that. In the same way that I feel it's a bit soon to say that Barcelona are contenders for La Liga, for example. Yeah. But to have someone to conduct the orchestra on the pitch is a great start. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. Whether either of them, the Netherlands or Barcelona, have that depth of quality is something I have a doubt over. But in both of these cases, like, Memphis has a coach who really appreciates him and really gets him.
And you never know how teams are going to turn up at the World Cup either. I mean, how many elite nations can you say they are right now that are untouchable who are going to be there? I don't think there's many.
We talked about France. They would have been that before the Euros.
Yeah.
But now it feels like there's a lot of work to do before November 2022. Yeah.
All the big nations have got question marks over them. Spain, Germany, England. Everyone's got something that they need to address before. So in that regard, I'd say the Netherlands definitely stand a chance. And also, I think the main thing for me is Frank de Boer isn't there anymore.
Yeah, I think that is big, but it does feel that the atmosphere, the mood around the Netherlands has all changed with that change of coach. And yeah, they have got an issue in terms of going forward, in terms of coaches, because they're not producing coaches like they used to, the Dutch. And the fact that they're going back to the same old names, it is a concern.
Yeah,
in the short to medium term, he is a coach who can do a terrific job with them. And these players have needed guidance. I think if Ronald Koeman had still been in charge, the Euros would have been a totally different prospect for the Netherlands, because they showed in moments in the groups that they could do interesting stuff. They didn't show anywhere like the know-how or the fortitude when it came to the Czechs, and particularly after the Lich sending off in the last 16. I mean, De Ligt is quite an interesting one, actually, because there's a feeling now that Stefan de Vrij, who is a really good defender, there's no getting away from it, and a really polished Serie A defender, but not of the same natural ability as De Ligt, I don't think it's unreasonable to say.
Absolutely.
that he's basically leapfrogged him now. So the thing is, I think as a international coach, you've sort of got your hands tied to a certain degree, because there's stuff that you can do, most of it's quite simple stuff. I think to structure your team and put it in the right direction, you can't reinvent the wheel because you don't have enough time to do it. What you can't also do is do the work with the players that they need to do at their clubs on a weekly basis. Now, I tend to think De Ligt is a bit of an interesting one because he obviously had his choice of Barcelona and Juventus when he left Ajax. You know, whether Barcelona could have financed that in retrospect, I mean, you know, it would have been another huge hole in their already drafty finances. De Ligt, despite playing with Bonucci and Chiellini, has not made the leaps that I would expect him to do. In bits at Juventus, he's been very, very good. But it doesn't feel to me, David, like he's in a good place at the moment. And for him to get in the place that the Netherlands need him to get into, that's going to be down to Max Allegri. That's not going to be down to Louis van Gaal.
Yeah, 100%. I think he's somebody, and don't get me wrong, he's still young, but yeah, I think now is the time where he does have to make that leap. Because also, there are a lot of really good young defenders around right now, and they'll all come up and he'll soon be forgotten about. So he'll still always be in the picture for the Netherlands, of course. But I think if you look around Europe, there's so many good young centre-backs coming through, coming around. And he's somebody I think now has a bit of pressure on him.
And they need him to be a leader, don't they? I mean, yeah. You know, you saw that even at the end of the Turkey game where Cengiz Under scored the most a pointless consolation goal of all time, really, right at the end, where Netherlands are 6-0 up and they overplay at the back a bit. And Van Dijk, trying to prevent it, gets a whack on the ankle.
Yeah.
And of course, after what's happened to him over the last year plus, you have that little, oh God, I hope it's not serious sort of business as he's like holding his leg and you're going, oh, it's not his knee. But it does just show, especially with how much they missed him during the Euros, they don't just need him as a defensive leader. De Ligt has to step up and take that mantle at some point.
Because he can lead as well. We saw it at Ajax. Yeah. He was an incredible lead. Absolutely remarkable.
Absolutely.
You don't get the captaincy in your teens, you know, just by being an okay leader. Mm. I just wonder, then you bring up Van Dijk and then you also bring up the incredible Juventus duo as well. But I wonder if he's a little bit intimidated by that. I wonder if he feels that he's still in the shadows about how do I step out when I've got these huge pillars in front of me? Van Dijk, Chiellini, Bonucci. Mm. How do I separate myself and start a lead and stand out when I've got these players in the way?
Taking the baton's not that easy, is it?
No, exactly. And he maybe needed to be at a club or a place where they are lacking any sort of leadership figure in defence. And that might have been where he could excel more.
Is it worth just spending one moment before we leave this topic on just trying to explain what the difference was that made Memphis Depay the player he is today? Just very quickly. I don't get it, actually. You know, fair enough, he wasn't at the right club before, etc. But something must have happened mentally or physically or psychologically for him.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about the coach, and I do think Bruno Genesio plays a role in it. But also, I think it's quite interesting the way that he ended up at Lyon in the first place. The fact that his agent used like research and algorithm, looking at how other teams played and the profile of their players, to sort of work out. It was almost a
scientific.
It was almost a sort of dating app. of find my perfect club. And it came up with Lyon, and they started talking and it really worked out with him. I think that's quite interesting, the idea of trying to match clubs and players, as you say, a little bit more scientifically rather than thinking, oh, he's good, we'll figure out a way to fit him in. I think that still happens like far too often in football. Yeah. Look at someone like, say, another guy who was fantastic in the Euros, Patrick Schick. Mm. Like, Roma signed him and never had a plan on how they were going to build a team around him, incorporate around him. And so they offered him like a club to play at, but no real direction to go in. And accordingly, they got odds and bits from him. Whereas clearly, the ability's there for him to totally excel.
So it was down to the dating app. That's how Memphis Depay got to Barcelona to be the main man there.
Et c'est dedans. Et c'est dedans. Memphis Depay à 90e minute qui vient redonner.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Let's talk about the Bundesliga there. And there is the return of an old wizard to his haunting grounds.
An old young wizard.
Yeah, young. Wizard doesn't mean your age. Yeah, not every wizard is cat weasel, okay? For those of a certain generation. Anyway, and so we're talking about Nagelsmann returning to Leipzig from Bayern Munich, where he is now. How is that likely to go down?
I think it's really interesting. I don't think he's likely to have to run a gauntlet of hate or anything like that, because it's simply not like that at Leipzig. I think there's an understanding from the fans, and of course it's a relatively new club, that people are there for a transient period. And that's how it is, especially with Nagelsmann. He always had his heart set on Bayern at some point. You know, we all know that he grew up with a Bayern Munich bedspread and all that sort of stuff. Maybe he's still got a Bayern Munich bedspread. He could probably get a discount at the club shop now, couldn't he? and so I think there's no sense of, you know, he stabbed us in the back or like left us in the lurch or anything like that. I think he'll get quite a warm reception, and he certainly deserves to, because he did a great job there. I think it's interesting to see him. The dynamic between the two coaches is very interesting to me, because he's coming face to face with his successor, of course, in Jesse Marsh, who, former guest on Ramble Meets. If you've not heard that, check it out on Football Ramble Presents. He's a fascinating, fascinating talker and a really good coach with a bit of Bundesliga experience before, because he was assistant at Borussia Mönchengladbach before. But I think that it's, even though Nagelsmann has got things he wants to change about Bayern over time, he's got enough quality around him and he's got enough smarts to not try and change it all overnight, and to be able to get results while he changes stuff over a gradual period. I think you look at Leipzig and Jesse Marsch is facing quite a difficult task, because they have signed quality, and of course André Silva is a massive upgrade in terms of the centre forward position for them. But you look at from last season, they've lost Dayo Upamecano, they've lost Ibrahima Konate, so the two best centre backs. They've now lost Marcel Sabitzer, the captain who had less than a year left on his contract to Bayern. He could potentially make his debut here, fitness permitting, though we'll wait and see. To try and impose your style whilst like reconditioning some quite important parts of the team, I don't think it's that easy.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading Lothar Matthäus, what he had said in his column, and he actually said, and I think you know what I'm going to say here, judging by your face. He said if Leipzig lose to Bayern, then that's it. The season's over for them, basically. And he said no one's coming back to make up, you know, that sort of gap on Bayern.
But it depends what you expect out of the season for them.
Yeah.
If you expect them to genuinely challenge for the league, then maybe that's a point, but...
And I don't. And we've kind of touched on this before as well. What is the remit at Leipzig? Is it a disappointment if you don't win the title? Is it a disappointment if you finish maybe 15, 20 points back? I don't know. Do you just keep the wheels in motion there? Keep the factory open, keep everything coming off the production line and such.
Develop the players, qualify for the Champions League.
To the philosophy. Make sure you're playing that brand of football, which clearly Marsh wants to try and, you know, wants to continue, but also, you know, add his own little tweaks to. So how much pressure is actually there? What is a must-win game for Leipzig? You know, I mean, obviously European football, I'd say, is essential for them and for their and how they develop their players. You know, it makes still an attractive proposition for players to come. They'll have European football and they are happy to be a stepping stone for a player to make his big before he makes his big move. You look at somebody like Szoboszlai has come in, such a wonderful player. And yes, they have lost a lot of talent, but they've also brought some in. Bring him in is a great example. What he has a good season. Even if Leipzig's season isn't that impressive, and then he moves on and he goes to whatever big club. And I think that is where they are, and that's what they are. And that's when I don't think there's that much pressure there. They're such a difficult team to discuss.
That's the thing. I don't think that image changes until the plan changes, because the plan is to develop those players and then maybe extract maximum value for them. If you get to a point where you say, we're going to supplement... Andre Silva and Szoboszlai and Nkunku with some experienced players, then people know you're serious about winning stuff. But they've always resisted that. They've always resisted going out and buying someone that's 30. The experienced players who are there, and I think a lot rests on Petr Gulácsi, the goalkeeper, and Vili Orban. They've been there since they're quite young and developed into senior players. A bit like, I suppose, a bit like Emil Forsberg, a bit like Sabitzer before he went. But they're not buying in experienced players because they feel that that's not the dynamic of the club. But I think eventually, if you're going to win stuff, I mean, I think you can very rarely blame stuff that goes wrong on the younger players. It's always you're as good as your senior players, I think. And if you're shying away from investing in senior players at any level, I think that makes it very hard to put yourself in a position to win the title. Because you remember they came up in 2017 and they finished second in 2017. And, you know, from there, it's like, well, okay, they've got money. They've got a plan. Maybe they could go on and challenge. But then, because you're looking for a genuine challenger for Bayern, but then... you get a little bit further down the road. And when they lose to PSG in the semi-finals of the Champions League, there is quite a strong sense of this is their ceiling. So for Marsh, it's got to be all about incremental gains, especially as he's changing the team around this season. I think if they finish top four and have a run in the Champions League, which is not off the table because, you know, he's produced with Salzburg, he's produced some really terrific Champions League performances. Obviously, it helps if you have Erling Haaland, but you know, he's not green in that competition. So I do feel that if they could finish top four and get to the knockout / quarterfinals of the Champions League, that would still represent a pretty strong season.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And whereas if you'd look at somebody, say, let's say Dortmund, say they maybe fell out the top three, say they were out of the Champions League at the group stages, then they would really assess where they are. And as we've seen with Dortmund as well, they've gone through a few coaches the last few years. And yes, of course, they're in a difficult position where the, you know, the player turnover that they have there, as we know, is quite rapid. But that is a difference in how they operate, I think. And if the if something bad did happen to Dortmund, then I think they'd really they'd address it quite sharply, I'd say. Whereas I just don't think it would happen in Leipzig. And that's why I think what you said, if they have a decent run, as long as they're just okay, as long as they're fine, then I think everyone's going to be happy. And I think you made a great point as well. Where does most of the pressure come from at football clubs these days? I don't think it's internally. I think it's from the fans. And like you said, the fans aren't, they're not going to, the players aren't going to run a gauntlet of hate or diatribe from
the
fans.
They're still grateful to have top flight football in Leipzig. Precisely. The reason that Red Bull were able to move in the first place is because there was a need to be filled.
Yeah.
That they felt, coming from the former East Germany, you know, they said there are no huge, I spoke to people there, they're like, there are no huge car manufacturers in the East or anything like that. The money, the investment has to come from somewhere. So whereas like Western Germany can turn their nose up at that, Leipzig were just happy to have football, which, you know, fall into low division teams and sort of terrorist violence and all that sort of stuff. They were ready to have a need for an upwardly mobile, I guess, like family football club field, really. But I do just wonder with Nagelsmann, it'd be interesting to see his demeanour, because obviously he's someone who's fiercely ambitious, and that's been clear ever since he was at Hoffenheim. I think when they go out of the Champions League in the way that they do in that semi-final to PSG in 2020, I think that's the moment where he thinks, yeah, maybe I'm not going to be here for the long term. You know, I mean, obviously when the Bayern job comes along, it's difficult to say no to anyway. But I think that's the point where he says, you know what, maybe this club isn't quite compatible with my ambitions, even in the medium term.
It's a very nice way of putting it. And you've got a nice way of putting things today, because you did very well, I thought, in swerving that old cliche, you don't win anything with kids. I thought you did really well there. Thank you for that.
All about the phrasing.
Thank you. The one question that remains for Nagelsmann ahead of this tie this weekend is, will he take mercy on Leipzig?
Well, they've had some pretty close games with Leipzig. So I think Leipzig could pull something out of the bag, particularly at home. They've lost their two away games so far. At Mainz, where they weren't great. Wolfsburg was a game that could have gone either way. And, you know, they're sort of competing in the same sort of places in the league. One of the few things that you could complain about with Nagelsmann is they didn't make themselves quite strong enough at home. Because I think, especially in that first season, there were too many draws at home, particularly in the back half of that campaign, that like take the wheels off their title train. Otherwise, they're a genuine title contender. I think one of the first things Marsh has to do is make them super strong at home, even if it's Bayern. I think that's really important. Now, Nagelsmann has got his own development things to work on. There's been a lot of talk before the break and during the international break about Leroy Sané, who of course is so brilliantly paid at Bayern, but hasn't really quite taken off yet. I think he needs a dedicated position. He needs coaching, and it's quite interesting because Nagelsmann has talked about that, and he's talked about understanding. He's like, well, like basically, a load of fans just shouting stuff at him isn't productive for anyone. Let's be kind to each other. It's really interesting language, I think, from a coach. And of course, one of Nagelsmann's favourite, the most famous ever phrases is football, coaching is 85% social competence and 15% tactics, which I think is a brilliant way of putting it. But he's someone who's tactically brilliant, but he understands that the majority of coaching, he's just getting a tune out of the players. It's just connecting to them on a personal level. And whether he does that with like his rubbish dancing in social media clips, his incredible selection of coats on the touchline, or just by the old-fashioned way of talking to them, it's something that he's very good at, and that's the ace in his pack. Ojo la falta. Le va a pegar Sané. El tiro de Sané.
Golazo de
Sané. Let's take a look at some of the tweets that have come in during the week for us. And do remember, you can join in by tweeting at Football Ramble or tweeting me at Dotton Adebayo, tweeting Andy at Andy Brassel, and tweeting David at David Jacka. That's at David J-A-C-A. This from Nathan. As a Welshman, I'd really love to know how Aaron Ramsey is viewed in Italy. Has he been a success at Juve? And where does he fit into Allegri's plans for this season?
It's a really interesting question, actually, Nathan, because he's someone who Allegri was really looking forward to working with, but they signed him, and then obviously he got the push before Ramsey actually arrived. Now, I suppose people at Juventus around the time, and the idea was he was going to play as a sort of number 10 in a very different role to Paulo Dybala, but in that same sort of position. So whether you're fitting them in the same team, I don't know. I think that's been one of the major issues. Now, I think particularly in last season, where they had a team where they'd have Chiesa, Dybala and Ramsey in it, you've got three very different players all eating the same space in the pitch, and it wasn't particularly productive. The coaches that have worked with Ramsey at Juventus have absolutely loved him. Like, Pirlo loved him. But I think he's really almost arrived there at sort of the wrong time, because they need a little bit more pace and energy in midfield. It's like Weston McKennie, who on a technical level, I think is far inferior to Aaron Ramsey, for example, why he's been so successful there. And I don't think anyone in Germany who saw him play for Schalke imagined him being quite as influential as he has for Juventus, McKennie. But he's the right player at the right time. And he's been lifted up by the players around him, I think, as well. So Ramsey's in a difficult situation, because his contract, David, if this was the NBA, would be classified as untradeable.
Yeah.
And he's a good player, but I don't know if he's exactly what Juventus need at the moment, even though he's had his good moments.
He's never played 90 minutes in two consecutive games in any competition since arriving at Juve.
Wow.
And when you consider that there's, I think it's Ronaldo, Dybala, and maybe one more who have paid more than him, as you've rightly pointed out there, it's quite damning, I think. No one is ever going to doubt what Ramsey is capable of as a footballer. I think he's an incredible footballer. I think he's absolutely remarkable. Supremely gifted, perfectly made for Serie A, perfectly made generally for the game on the continent, as well as the Premier League. I think we saw what he's done with Wales as well. As influential as Gareth Bale on his day, I think the way that he operates, you know, such a wonderful, rare, I think, a box-to-box talent that is also incredibly gifted technically. He doesn't just rely on physicality, which a lot of box-to-box players do. And he is brilliant in that sense. But it's just always been about fitness. Consecutive games with him. Ramsey's somebody you want to see play every single game. And unfortunately, we don't get to see that. And I don't know if we will ever get to see that again, which is such a shame, because he is brilliant to watch.
This is from JD, who says, for David, how do you think Sevilla will use El Naziri and Mir? What do you think of the signing of Mir, given Atleti's were favourites to get him? And can Sevilla mount a serious title challenge this season?
Yes, Sevilla can absolutely mount a serious title challenge this season. And I think for the reason that they have got so many different parts in different roles. I think the fact that they have got En-Naziri to play when they are playing on the break, when they are playing, when they need somebody to operate and add a lot of width to the team, then they have En-Naziri. Then if they also want to go route one, or if they want to put in a lot of crosses, because they play a really, really nice wing-back system. Julen Lopetegui really, really likes his fullbacks to get forward. They've bought plenty as well over the summer. And they're going to put a lot of crosses in. Rafa Mir will really like that. He's an excellent header of the ball. He's excellent aerial presence, I think. Physical presence for them. I think he's a better, he's a great replacement for Luke de Jong, in my opinion. A lot more mobile, adds a lot more as a second striker as well. And I think it's shaping up to be I think the buys that Sevilla have made say to me, we're serious about, you know, going far in various competitions. This isn't just a squad made up to chase the Champions League, the final Champions League place pack, the usuals, what they're part of. I think they do want to mount a title challenge. I think they see a gap there as well with Barcelona, Real Madrid and having their issues and only Atleti kind of having any consistency.
I can't believe we got through that without talking about Eric Lamela.
Well done. Mm. And this final one from United Iconic is Southgate just Ole, as in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? Is Southgate just Ole with a waistcoat? A lack of substitutions and an insistence on playing a double pivot will only get you so far and no more. He's a good man manager, tactically limited, relies on individual brilliance. Is he Ole without the waistcoat or with a waistcoat?
Southgate doesn't even have the waistcoat anymore.
It's old news, is that?
Yeah, no, I didn't realize. He's moved on, I believe.
What about the beard? Has he still got that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just checking. So he hasn't moved on that far. Yeah, he hasn't moved on that far.
Well, of course, Solskjaer's going to have a whole new challenge from this weekend as he starts managing Cristiano Ronaldo, which be interesting.
Very interesting. But as for Southgate, I think last night summed him up really well. You know, he said, you know, he didn't make any substitutions at all, and he said they were in total control. I mean,
this is against Poland.
Yeah. I think it's such a cop out phrase, and again, I think substitutions and tactical changes and in game management are things that he views as problems as opposed to solutions. I think he thinks it's a bit of a headache, really looking at it, and. Yeah, I think he's incredibly limited, and it's a shame because I think England have got one of the best, you know, talent depths that they've had ever. I think you look at the level of the players that they have; it's quite remarkable. And unfortunately, I think, you know, he's probably going to get a new contract and he's going to stay a while with England. But I don't think England are ever going to go far with him in terms of, you know, just getting over that hill, you know, winning that competition, beating the big teams. I don't think they're going to do it. Southgate is the guy at work who's a nice guy who you'll have your lunch with, who you'll have a little chat with about the TV last night. But would you go for drinks with him after work? Probably not.
I was thinking in a different. My mind was coming at it from a different direction from David's, but I was thinking that for me Southgate is got an impossible task ahead of him, and well, there's so much pressure. That whatever he says and whatever he does, he's always going to look as if... Well, it's easy. It's interesting how quickly the shine was taken off the Euro's success by this result against Poland, you know? You forget about the Euros. Semi-final, final, doesn't matter.
I think it would be a bit short-sighted to do that. And, you know, it could be in a worse position. It could be Didier Deschamps if we're talking about pressure.
Game of the week from each of you, if you don't mind. Andy, do you want to go first? No, David, Andy, which one? Andy, David? Andy?
Right, I'm going to take it to Portugal. I'm going to go for Sporting versus Porto on Saturday night at 8:30. Sporting, well-deserved champions last season. And I think you look at the quality of coaches at the top of the Portuguese Liga at the moment. It's amazing. Jorge Jesus isn't even in the top two. It's these two. It's Ruben Amorim, Sergio Conceição. It will be interesting to see if Porto can get the result, which would mean the title race would be properly on.
David?
Yes, mine is Saturday night in La Liga. Athletic Bilbao versus Real Mallorca. Mallorca have won two of their three games since coming up, being promoted. they're looking a really nice little side. And it's always a good
they're
test.
They're Brentford, are they?
Yeah, yeah, essentially. Yeah, yeah, yeah. that's a good way to say it. I'm sure Brentford residents will say something about it not being quite like Palmer in terms of weather or what have you. But anyway, yes, they look very, very good, Mallorca. And going to San Mamés, you know, full capacity or not, is always an interesting test. You'll get physical battering as well. And Athletic Bilbao unbeaten themselves, but there's a few more question marks surrounding them. They're still not quite there. They still don't look the full package. So it'll be interesting to see if Mallorca, and they've got some very talented young players as well, can see if they can rattle them.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.